You know, the reason they like reading my stuff is that I've always got real-life examples to prove what I'm saying.
There's a lot of good people that listen to this podcast.
You know, other than God and my family, deer hunting would be next in line on my list of priorities.
From the bottom of our hearts, it's just fantastic and awesome to have the support that you guys are giving.
People ask me about expandable broadheads and love swings.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Well, welcome everyone to the Chasing Giants podcast with Don Higgins and Terry Peer, brought to you by Osseo Gear. Don, it's closing in on the end of May, but buddy, we've been almost underwater for since the last podcast.
Yeah, it rained here all day today again. I still have some food plot work to do, but just about the time it dries out enough to do something, it rains again. So it's going to be a few more days.
Well, it's been a week since we've heard from you. I think you'd had some of your food plot put in last we talked, and you were going to do a new tree stand this week. What all did you end up getting done with the weather?
Well, I did get a new tree stand up. I only got one more I want to get up before summer, but summer's about here. And then this summer when I start getting velvet pictures, there may be a chance of hanging another one or two, but one more and I'll be done with the stand work for the spring. I planted a couple more plots this week. I did get a sunflower plot in right behind my house, which will go into Deadly Dozen this fall. Once the sunflowers mature, I'll just mow them over and use the Genesis drill to no-till Deadly Dozen right into that plot. I planted a little clover strip along the edge of a soybean plot. It's a little bit late for planting clover, but with the rain we're getting, I don't think it's going to matter. I think it's going to do fine. And headed to Mississippi on Monday. I spent quite a bit of time conversing with a new client, and real interesting situation on a 1,600-acre property in Mississippi. And I'll save the details until I get back from my trip, but this client is flying into my local airport with a private jet to pick me up on Monday, taking me to Mississippi. Actually, he's flying down to Cincinnati as well to pick up Steve Shields. And Steve and I are going to Mississippi until Tuesday evening. And then they're flying us back home. And this is going to be a multi-year project. They had a couple of things they wanted to do this summer and wanted to get my input before they start those projects. And then I'll go back this winter for at least 3 days. And then he wants me to come back every winter for about the next 5 years for 2 or 3 days, just till we get everything up to speed. And on a property that big, you know, 1600 acres, we're talking almost 3 square miles. So it's going to take a little bit for me to learn the property and get it fine tuned, but kind of excited about that.
Well, and we're not going to share all the details right now, but there's some very specific objectives that this property is going to be used for that might be a bit different for one or two guys going in and just hunting mature bucks. So I think that goal that the landowner has for you is going to also take some adapting and understanding. That you can't look at it in 1 or 2 days and be done. This is going to be a big project to make it work the way he wants to.
Yeah. When people hear the whole story, they'll understand why I'm excited about this. There's going to be some big name people hunt this property that I'm sure most of the listeners are going to recognize those names. And I even brought Dr. Bronson Strickland into the fold here. It's about 2 hours from where he's at, but he's going to make the drive on Tuesday and give me some local expertise. When I'm on a property here in the Midwest and I'm walking through, I can identify just about every single tree, shrub, weed, bush, whatever I see. That's getting just a little bit out of my comfort zone. I've done some forestry work in Mississippi, believe it or not, when I had the conservation tree planting service. I would collect seed here locally, and then I would take it to a grower in Mississippi, and he would grow that seed into tree seedlings down there. And the reason I did that was because they can get in one growing season what would take two growing seasons up, here in the Midwest where I'm at.
Right.
And the guy that was growing these tree seedlings for me was a deer hunter. So, every year I'd spend a couple of different trips down to Mississippi and spend time with him, looking at his property and going for tours on places he hunted and such. I hunted Alabama way back in 1987. So I do have a little experience hunting in the South and specifically with Mississippi. But, when you start looking at very specific plant species, you need to know what you're looking at. You need to know if it's a deer friendly species, something they're going to browse on, or if it's something that, the deer are it's not going to benefit the deer whatsoever. And that's why I brought Dr. Strickland into the fold, is he's going to be able to help with the species identification on some of those plants that I might not be able to.
Yeah. And the amount of tissue analysis that he's done, and not only identifying, but also knowing the nutritional value of all those plants will be vital for it. So look forward to more of the story and seeing a lot of the pieces of this thing come together over the next couple of years. It's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And it's a very unique situation. I've never been involved in a project like this, but really excited to get started on it.
Yep. So outside of the trip to Mississippi, you're rained out today, so tomorrow's probably pretty well shot. What food plot work do you have left that you need to get done? And you're pretty much coasting till July 4th weekend when we put cameras out.
Yeah, I've got to plant my corn plot yet. I've been saving that one for Steve Shields to come up here and video the whole process, because we're testing some new corn varieties this year, and I want to get that all video documented. So the main thing I got left is my corn plot, and I got one small soybean plot that I saved for when Steve's here as well. But if we get the right weather, I can wipe it out in a day. Just need for things to dry out a little bit.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting spring, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully in another week when we record the next podcast, I'll be all done and on cruise mode waiting on July to put them cameras out.
Yeah. So this week was a little bit interesting for me. I know everybody kind of wants this checklist for what I had to get done, but we finished up high school softball season this week, so I was in full anticipation of flying in and getting everything kind of wrapped up. Took a personal day from work on Friday, and we got an unbelievable rainstorm come through Thursday night, and it was just too wet, but I was able to get some other stuff done. And I flew in this morning and was able to get all of my residual down on all of my fields, which that takes time when you only have one sprayer like I do, because you're spraying your bean residual, then you're spraying your corn residual and having to clean out tanks in between it, make sure that, everything, you don't have any carryover. So that took a lot of time this morning by the time I could finally get in the field. And then I got all my beans. I broadcast my beans here. Got all of that done and then cultipacked in, and then went home and got the tractor and the corn planter, and got about an acre and a half planted of NutriCrave corn. And then on one of the big food plots that's up beside the house, my wife's grandmother's house, that is, right really behind the barn, I put about an acre of sweet corn out, so that if the deer eat it, the deer eat it. But if not, we can go out and pick some sweet corn this year. But I was finishing up... one of the things that I usually do a little bit of, I don't talk about it too much, is usually one part of my soybean field or one small field, depending on the rotation, is I'll broadcast my beans in it, cultipack in, and then plant my corn, some Roundup Ready corn, right over the top of it. So it'll have beans and corn in the same area. And I don't do much of that, but I've had pretty good luck with putting that together. And I just got that done when the sky opened up and rained me out. So the only thing that I have left to do from a food plot standpoint is I need to, the same corn that you're talking about that we're testing, we're trying to grow that in a couple different states so that we have some data points on it. I need to put about 2/3 of an acre of that in. And then I'm going to use some more of that Roundup Ready corn and box in a couple of the other soybean plots. That way, if I have to slip in or out, or, you know, I got a pretty hard edge, and not have to worry about when I spray my soybeans that I kill the corn. So, but with the way it rained, I tell you what, I was awful happy I had a cab tractor tonight. Yeah. I put the flashers on, and I didn't even fool with trying to load it up on the trailer. I just drove it the 5 miles home, and I didn't want to load it up on that slick trailer. So, I was happy for a cab tractor tonight. That was for sure.
Yeah, they come in handy. You'll like it this summer when it's 100 degrees and you're trying to mow clover or something too.
Well, I got a picture I want to share with you on here. I know the people listening on MTech aren't going to be able to see it, but I'll describe it afterwards. And, you guys had better luck up in Illinois coming up with the residual herbicides than what I could get access to down here. So you found the Kyber at a local chemical dealer up by you, and then took it to the office, and then also shipped me some corn residual. Well, I'd open the box up to make sure nothing had leaked, but I hadn't pulled the bottles out yet until today, and I had those in the back by the sprayer. And I go to open it up, and I don't know if you can see that or not, but that was on the top of the... So our buddy Wes Delks decided he's going to take a Sharpie and write "Wes is the man" all over the lid of my corn herbicide. So I don't know if you had anything to do with that, but I'm glad Wes cleared that up. You know, I don't know if we were doubting that or what.
Kids, you give them a Sharpie or you give them a can of spray paint, and they're going to put graffiti on something. And I guess Wes decided that he was going to decorate your jug for you.
Yeah, I opened up that box and looked down, and I'm like, what in the world does that say? This part is actually only going to be on the audio version. But before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about, for the people listening on MTech or any of the podcasts, we're going to just touch on so people understand what's going on about YouTube. And again, I'm going to edit this portion of it out, but this last podcast episode, we don't get on political rants very often, and even when we do, they don't last real long. But you had made a comment about the election getting fixed, and I guess the filters or algorithms that YouTube runs finally caught up to you about Wednesday or Thursday this week and gave you a little slap on the wrist.
Yeah, they gave me one strike, they called it, against my YouTube account, and also banned us from posting a new video for, I don't remember if it was a week or a day. I don't pay much attention to what they say anyway. It's you're not even talking to a person. But it all stems from last, and when I got it, I'm like, what did we even say? And I think I said something about the movie 2000 Mules that's out about the 2020 election. And if you watch that movie, there's absolutely no doubt. And they've got the video proof and everything, and geo tracking on phones of these people that were stuffing ballot boxes. And there's no doubt whatsoever that the election was rigged in favor of Biden. I mentioned that, and the liberals don't like anybody having an opinion that's different than theirs. And so we got in a little trouble with YouTube, but.
So yeah, this is this part that you're listening to right now. If you're watching on YouTube, you're not hearing it because I'm not going to get us put in probation again. But there's two key points that I want to make before we move on to the listener submitted question segments. But number one, we've had a lot of people speak up about how much they appreciate our willingness to talk openly about what we feel is right, and that's our faith and our belief in Jesus, and then our commitment to helping others through Lester's Feet. And then occasionally we're not trained broadcasters or anything, so obviously every once in a while we get fired up and get off on a little political tangent. But then there's been a few people that have said, oh, well, we don't like Chasing Giants anymore because you guys don't focus all on this. And I tell you what, folks, we appreciate the people who continuously support us and listen to us. We're not going to make everybody happy. And no matter what we do, there's always going to say people that want us to do it differently. But for the tens of thousands of people that are loyal listeners to this every weekend, we really, really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, Terry, it's I think that, like you said, no matter what we do, somebody's going to disagree with it. You know, you might have seen the post I made here recently where my daughter was telling me one morning that my 7-year-old grandson has started using the word Democrats instead of Democrat, Democrats. And she thought it was for me, but to be honest, I don't think I've ever said the word. I'm not sure where he picked it up, but I'll gladly take the blame. But anyway, I got chewed out by one person saying that I shouldn't be teaching my grandkids to call people names. So no matter what we do, there's going to be criticism. And like you said, we appreciate those that stick with us. The majority of this podcast is going to be about chasing mature bucks. But we're also going to use our platform to share our faith, and we're also going to use it to help others, and we're going to use it to share our views as patriots. Now, we're not going to get on rants every single episode, but on occasion, if it comes up in conversation, it's hard telling what you might hear, but you're not ever going to have to worry about where we stand on an issue.
Yeah. The second point, and this is where you and I are going to really disagree, and that is the number of people that are bashing YouTube for basically taking us off, you know, taking that episode down and then warning us. And I know a lot of people commented about freedoms of speech and everything. I take a very different look at this. And I know I'm gonna really stir the pot here. But, you know, YouTube is a free avenue, just like Facebook, where we can get content out to people. And it doesn't mean that we align or we agree with the positions that they take. But I am 100% for them being a private organization to say who and what they want to allow on their site, because we agreed as the membership. And this is the reason why. And this is where you're really going to get aggravated with me. I don't want us at Chasing Giants to ever have to give in for someone coming on saying, this is what we're saying on your episode. We deserve the right for Chasing Giants to say what content we're going to put out there and what we're not, just like YouTube should also. And same goes with our churches. I don't think it's right because there's one side bias so much. But at the same time, if they want to play by those rules, we have to agree to those rules and go look for something else, which that's a little bit of a teaser for you, because that's exactly what we're doing, is finding another way to get the word out there.
I disagree.
I know you do.
And here's why, because if you turn on the TV to watch your nightly news, that news broadcasting station is a private company. But we are depending on them to give us the news, not some slanted opinion of what they want us to think. And yet that's a big issue with our society today, in my opinion, is that we can't trust the news anymore. We've gone so far to the left with these radical media outlets, be it the CNN or YouTube, that we're not even getting both sides of the story, and we're not even getting the truth anymore. But I totally understand what you're saying. We don't want anybody coming on telling us what we've got to say. So, I mean, there's a good argument can be made either way, but I think if it's a public media outlet, which basically is what YouTube is, freedom of speech should be exercised to a certain degree, more than what they're allowing. Now, I don't believe you should be able to get on there and threaten people's lives or you know, make racist comments or things like that. But I do think when it comes to politics, you should be able to voice your view either way on the political spectrum.
Yeah. So, like I said, the reason for me even bringing it up is Don's talked about this video project he's working on for a couple year or for a couple months now, and we have this thing cooking. So we're really excited that this content's going to be made available soon. And that the reason we're going with that direction, not only for content of the podcast, but also hunting videos, is we're just not sure about how much YouTube or any of the other outlets are going to possibly squeeze us as far as what we want to talk about or show hunting videos. So we hope everybody is going to stay tuned for that. Speaking of outlets, I'm going to share a schedule with everybody before our first question. And you can walk through about your extended travel schedule the month of July. We're going to do the Lester's Feet Raffle July 4th. And then the following week, you got a whirlwind tour.
Yeah, I'm going to be gone from home about 11 days on a seminar tour. And I'm going to go down the schedule is on the screen for those watching the video. But for those who are listening only, I'm going to run down that list of where I'm going to be in July. And in a future podcast, we're going to give more details about each one of these events. But it's going to start on July 13th in Eden, Ohio. Then July 14th, I'm going to be in Fredonia, Pennsylvania. July 15th, I'll be in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. July 16th, I'll be in Oakland Mills, Pennsylvania. Then the 17th is a Sunday, which I will not be speaking on Sunday. July 18th will be a Monday, and I'll be in Penn Yan, New York. Then on July 19th, I'll be back in Pennsylvania at Ulysses, Pennsylvania. July 20th, Canton, New York. That's at our Real World Dealer, Bordeaux Brothers. They've got three events, 3 days in a row. July 20th, Canton, New York. July 21st, Detroit, Maine. July 22nd, Sheldon, Vermont. And then the last seminar will be July 23rd in Canajoharie, New York. I hope I said that right. Canajoharie, maybe. Canajoharie, New York. So there's 10 speaking engagements right there, all there in the heart of July, all at Real World Dealers. So those are also listed on my social media, both Instagram and Facebook. And more details will be posted there, and we'll be sharing more details here. But just wanted to let everybody know that I'll be in that part of the world in July and hope to see a lot of you there.
Yeah, the especially for our Amish friends that are listening on MTech or others, we will give you the down low of each one of those so you know what's going on, so you can make arrangements. Some of them might be a small fee to get in, but then you get a coupon or something in return. Some of them are just going to be an open house or a seminar. So each event is going to be a little bit different. There is not one promoter that is doing this as kind of a tour. this is different events except for the three that are at Bordeaux Brothers. So again, those are just the dates. So you can go ahead and start looking at your calendar to come out and visit and meet Don. But we'll go into individual schedules of each one to let you know what to do and maybe a phone number or whatever to learn more about the event. So let's take a quick break and hear from our friends at Osseo Gear.
Osseo Gear introduces a premium line of bow hunting gear that is unmatched, pairing nature's finest camouflage with the best technological innovations. Osseo Gear brings whitetail bow hunters the gear they need to be the best at their craft. The unique camouflage mimics the intricate feather pattern of North America's greatest predatorial creatures. Designed for invisibility, built for comfort, and engineered for function. Visit osseogear.com. That's A-S-I-O-Gear.com to start shopping. Osseo Gear, prepare to be invisible.
All right, Don. Well, let's get into our first question of the week. That is from one of our listeners out in Iowa, I believe.
Yeah, the first one comes from John Labar from West Des Moines, Iowa. John says, I never thought I would ever get so hooked on podcasts. Really enjoy your show, and the question and answer part of your podcast is by far my favorite. I heard on one of the episodes that one of your clients was going to protect his property from neighbors hunting his fence line by erecting a fence. How high would a fence need to be to work in deterring deer from crossing a fence? Once again, really enjoy your podcast. Well, John, a 6-foot fence is going to deter 98% of all deer crossing. If a deer is really pressured, say it's being chased by, who knows, coyotes or hunters or whatever, they could probably clear a 6-foot fence, but a 6-foot fence is going to deter. It's going to totally change the patterns of the deer. They're not going to jump it. They're going to work their way around the end of it and avoid it. If you want to stop 100% of that deer crossing, you need to go with an 8-foot fence. I can tell you that in just the last couple of years in my consulting business, you know, I've looked at over 150 properties, between 150 and 200 properties in the last two winters. And clients fencing off bad neighbors is becoming more and more common. It's just a growing theme that I see. It seems to be growing each year where, you know, a client has got one bad neighbor on one side of his property and he just can't work with them. These guys are going and they're erecting fences. So it's becoming a bigger part of the landscape. You know, I've said in the past that Texas, when it comes to wildlife and especially whitetail management, Texas is about 25 years or so ahead of the rest of the world. And if you think about it, high fences have been in Texas for a long time, and they're coming to the Midwest and the rest of the world. Now, I don't think they're coming to the extent that they are in Texas, because Texas is, the ranches in Texas are a lot bigger than what they are in much of the rest of the country. But I don't see people in the rest of the world totally enclosing a property like they do in Texas. But I do see them using fences to shut off a bad neighbor. And you know, to each his own, I'm not going to promote it and I'm not going to bash it. I think in a lot of cases, if the states did a little better job of managing for mature deer, there would be a lot less of that. But, you know, the regulations being what they are, a person that wants to try to grow mature deer, sometimes his hand is forced to do that. And in the interest of full disclosure here, I do have a high fence down one side of my property. My north side, I had one bad neighbor who was letting every Tom, Dick, and Harry hunt his 5 acres, which included his house and his yard. They would shoot deer as they came off of me, and when they shot them, they would run right back into my sanctuary, and it just got to be too much. And one fence down one side of my property, and problem solved. So I can understand it. I'm not promoting it. Each person is going to have to make their own choice. But if you do it, you're going to need at least a 6-foot fence.
So I have a question, not about whether using a tall fence is right or wrong, but the strategy of implementing it. So let's say I have a 300-yard property line on, say, the east side of my property that neighbors set the property line, shoot deer coming out or always pushing deer, causing me a lot of issues setting on the property line. And I want to take that 300-yard section or right side of the property and put up a 6-foot, 8-foot fence. So the deer can obviously go around it on either side. It's not boxed in, but just that. So if I'm looking at it from an aerial, what do I do on my property at the halfway point? So on my side of the fence, I can't get there. I don't want the deer going back and forth. Do I just add as thick a cover as I can up against that fence? Do I put food there? What if you're going to implement that strategy, what do you do for the distance in between where the deer can go around, say, the north or the south side? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It varies. And, you know, ironically, this is one of the reasons I'm going to look at this property in Mississippi, because this landowner, and again, it's 1,600 acres, but there's one part on that property where there's been a lot of trespassing in the past. This property has supposedly been off limits to hunting, but there is so many tree stands and there's a major creek or river that goes through it that a lot of people fish, and it's become almost like public hunting. And this new client is, you know, he realizes what he's dealing with, and he knows to stop it, he's going to have to erect a fence. And so he wants to do that this summer before we get, you know, too far into the whole project. And one of the things I'm going to be looking at is, where do we end the fence? Because wherever you end that fence, it creates a funnel, and it creates a funnel for you, and it creates a funnel for the neighbor that is on the other side of that
right end
of the fence. So you got to be careful, you know, where you end them. And that's one of the things we're going to be looking at this week. What you do in the middle is going to depend on a lot of different factors. Do you have access across the neighbor, you know, at some point? You may be like my situation. I'm only blocking off 5 acres, but I had to make 2 hitches at this fence. I started at the road and I went past this 5 acres. That was the problem, but I didn't go far enough, and those deer were just funneling around the end of my fence and still hitting that 5 acres, still being an issue. The next year I had to add on where I'd left off the year before and go the entire length of my north side, and I took care of the situation. So you got to be really careful where you end it, because you can help your neighbor just as much as you know, yourself.
Yeah, and that's the reason for me asking these questions, to dive a little deeper, because I don't want someone to think, oh, I'll just put a fence down 300 yards is going to fix all my problem, because you're going to create that funnel when those deer figure out where the fence ends and they hook around it. I don't know that it's a great thing to have food right on the other side of a fence, you know, because if you got that bad of neighbors, you're going to put deer close to the fence. They're going to shoot them and cut a hole in the fence and drag them out. Or necessarily bedding, where if they're hunting that property wrong next to you, they're scent blowing into your sanctuary just like normal. So the reason for me teeing that up for you a little bit is I don't want people to think it's just as easy as, oh, I'm going to run a fence down here, without putting a lot of thought and a lot of understanding into your property to say, this is where it goes, this is where it ends, and this is what I do up against it.
Yeah, and I should probably stress that, you know, I encourage you to work with your neighbors as much as possible. But, you know, let's be real here. There's some people that are just impossible to work with, and their goals are totally different than yours. And you've invested, you know, probably hundreds of thousands, if not more, dollars in your property, you know, for certain uses to reach certain goals. It very well may be that that fence is the final investment that you need to make to be able to reach those goals. And without it, you're never going to reach them. Right. So And, you know, I'm not encouraging or discouraging anyone to build or not build a fence. It's just an option to consider if your neighbor is not going to work with you.
Well, we'll bring it up on the podcast so all the people can make accusations about you hunting inside of a high fence now. That's yeah, where it'll go now. It never fails, but that's how it rolls.
I just wanted to be 100% clear. You know, who else is going to get on a podcast and admit they've got a fence down one side of their property? I'm telling you, nobody in the hunting industry is as transparent as I don't know of anybody. They'll keep you in the dark as much as they can and beat their chest. Look what I've just done. And I'm just being transparent. If you don't like it, you don't have to listen.
All right. Well, we have a really good segment with Ian Metcalf, a new agent for BioFarm. So let's take a quick break and hear about the BioFarm.com property of the week.
BioFarm.com is your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. Now, here is Don Higgins with this week's featured property.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to the BioFarm.com segment of this episode. And I'm honored to have Ian Metcalf from BioFarm on the line with us. This is your first time on the podcast, Ian.
Yeah, it is. I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a specific property, but I believe you just started working for BioFarm not too long ago, and you're a deer hunter yourself, and you have a fantastic property in Jackson County, Illinois, for either one or a group of guys to come in and use as a recreational property, but possibly also get some income off of it.
Yeah, no, it's a... I think it's a really unique piece. It's primarily ag that's in row crop production. So that offers a lot of money to be made off of cash rent. So that gives you the opportunity to make some money while also still being able to enjoy it recreationally. There's a pond on the property that offers for some fishing, and there's deer, there's turkey. It's close to Crab Orchard Waterfowl Refuge. So there's some opportunities for some waterfowl hunting. So I think it's pretty unique and it offers a lot of possibilities for somebody.
Okay. So for the people who are at their computer or going to research this, you're going to go to biofarm.com and search Jackson County, Illinois. And this is the 314 acre piece. Now I'm sitting here and sharing some of the pictures above. And, you know, Don and I talk all the time about people who want to start with a clean slate. And this gives us a balance of some woods, a creek, a pond, but then open ag where you could immediately put this into CRP or put some native grasses in with a combination of food plots and strategic areas. It looks like from what we were seeing on here and what you've told me, there's access in two different directions, and depending on how you got along with the neighbors, possibly a third. So this could be a clean slate for someone that's the serious deer hunter that wanted to develop this. But I tell you, I really like zooming out on the topo and seeing how much connecting woods is around it. So you could probably really draw those deer in with food.
Yeah, it is definitely the main source of food in the area. I've actually been hunting the property for the past 2 years. And one of my favorite things is to go out there in the summer and glass the bean fields. And to be quite honest with you, if I go out there in an evening in the summer and I don't see 15, 20 plus deer in that field, I'm kind of shocked and disappointed with how the night went. It definitely is just the main source of food in the area. And like you said, with how big and open those fields are, there's a lot of possibilities for modifying the property to kind of suit more of what you're after. You know, if you can afford to take some of it out of row crop production or even leave some of it, you know, buy the crop from the farmer, I think you could do really, really well out there. But also if it's one of those things where you need to hunt it as is, I think you can do really, 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 really well with how it is right now.
Yeah. So for the people who are listening that maybe can't pull this up on a computer right now, this is around the Carbondale area, just west of I-57, if I'm not mistaken. So kind of northwest of Paducah. By how much would you guess?
Probably about an hour and a half or so. It's okay. Just off Route 13 in between Carbondale and Marion. It's old. Both entrances to the farm are just about a mile and a half off of 13, so it's really easy to get to, real centrally located. Two real good entrances that are hard road. You don't have to worry about, you know, oh, am I going to be able to get to the property if it snows or if it rains too much or...
Yeah, and that's really important, you know, for guys that are maybe coming out of St. Louis or Paducah or whatever to have this as a hunting lease. You know, a lot of these real rural properties, you might get a flash flood and not even be able to get to the property. So that's not a concern in this place. But, you know, I really like the fact that it's a lot of ground priced reasonably, that you could make money back and basically agriculturally help make that payment every month. And probably in a net situation, maybe even get it cheaper than what you would pay for just a trespass license or a lease.
Yeah, it really, and it's an area that's known for producing big deer. And like you said, that's the main source of food in the area. When you zoom out, that property that is the southwest of it that borders it, that property, oh, it's well over 500 acres. And it's in a WRP tree farm type program. So beautiful. It's all real thick.
Yep.
Real thick bedding cover that the deer just absolutely love.
Right.
They all come piling out of there. And during the rut, the best part is that creek bottom that borders the property. And you'll get deer that just cruise that bottom, because that bottom leads to that thick bedding and borders the ag all the way around.
Absolutely.
Anywhere along that bottom, there's bucks that are going to be cruising during the rut without a doubt. And I mean, I've witnessed it myself and killed a few myself doing that. So
fantastic. So for those of you who are interested in learning more about this property, go to buyafarm.com, search Jackson County, Illinois, and you'll see it pop up. And Ian, why don't you go ahead and just give people your contact info if they want to contact you directly about this property?
Yeah, that sounds great. Like I said, my name is Ian Metcalf. My phone number is 618-310-4750, and then my email through the company is imetcalf@buyafarm.com. And feel free to give me a call, email anytime. I'm willing to answer the phone. I got it on me pretty much 24/7, which is a blessing and a curse. But looking forward to hopefully showing it to a few more people and getting some passionate deer hunters out there interested in it.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, Ian. And like I said, reach out and make sure you're following Buy Farm on their social media and visit this property in Jackson County, Illinois. Thanks, Ian. And thanks to all the folks at Buy Farm for their continued support of the Chasing Giants podcast.
All right, Don. Well, I'm going to put up question number two for you to read off.
All right. Our next question comes from Spencer Bridges of Brentwood, Tennessee. Spencer says, how many total deer, bucks, and does do you keep on your 120-acre farm in Illinois? I'm going to guess around 45 based on the way you talk about how you manage bucks. You try to kill as many does as you do bucks. Thanks. Well, Spencer, that number varies widely by the time of the year. Right now, we're in late spring. The does are going to be having fawns anytime now. My deer numbers here are probably the lowest that they're going to be for the entire year. And I'm guessing right now, I would guess I probably got around 10 deer on my farm at any one time. Now in the wintertime, I will have the most. When food's scarce, I've got the most security cover and I got, all the food. I will have probably on an average winter, 60 to 80 deer staying here. And that's the other extreme. In between those two extremes, it just varies. In the fall, when the bucks start to, I don't have a lot of bucks here in the summertime. Very rarely do I have any buck. If I do, it's usually a year and a half old buck just passing through, as he's relocating and trying to establish his home range. But in the fall, when those bachelor groups start breaking up, that's when I start having bucks show up here. And that number just slowly builds over the entire fall, right on into the winter, as crops are harvested, hunting pressure picks up around me. I got the safest place in the neighborhood, as well as all the food a deer could want. So it varies. And you asked about shooting does. I live in an area where there is not a lot of deer. When I say I've got 60 to 80 deer in the wintertime, I've got almost, not 100%, but I bet you I've got the vast majority of all the deer in my entire township staying on my place. And, you know, you talk about a township that's only got 100 deer in it, that's not that many deer for a township. And I'll have 60 to 80 of those on my place. So I don't shoot a lot of does. Now, I used to years ago. I had a different management philosophy, and I was trying to shoot two does for every buck I shot. At that time, I was really concerned with buck-doe ratios. And what I found is that it's almost impossible for a single landowner to have much impact on buck-doe ratios. You're going to have, you know, almost the entire county working to get those ratios in order. And I gave up, and that's when I started, you know, more or less implementing the buck management approach that I talk about with Dr. Strickland. I do shoot does on occasion, and if I do, it'll be a doe that's got twin buck fawns with her, to keep those buck fawns from dispersing and increasing the odds that they're going to live out their life on my property or real close here. So I don't shoot a lot of does whatsoever. I think since 2000, and we got hit with a real bad EHD outbreak in 2012. And since that time, I think there's been two does shot on my farm. Both had button bucks with them.
Right. So I think, your approach that you're talking about is for your home farm. That might differ if you're consulting on a different property that has different habitat, different surroundings. But what people have to understand with your home farm is if you kill 10 does, you're going to pull 10 does right back in there because you have the only food in the winter. People take what you say on this podcast about your home farm as what they should do in every area of the country. And that's simply not it. That's why YouTube and all of these other outlets can be so dangerous with people listening to people with different philosophies. That has to be evaluated per property, per area, based on need, desire, and basically the ecosystem that's there. So I think people take you a little bit too literally sometimes with what you do at a home farm versus what you do them. I mean, think about it this way. The property that we've both had 30 minutes from your house, we would handle that completely different than, and there's only 30 miles difference between those, but what surrounds it is completely different, and we would put a completely different plan together for that.
That's a fantastic point, Terry, because when I go set up a property for a consulting client, a lot of times we are trying to shoot some does. And what we're trying to do is kill those does in an area on the property that's going to create the least amount of disturbance. And a lot of times it's up close to a cabin or a house or a barn or something like that. It really works ideal in a state like Ohio or Kentucky, where you can bait. We'll bait those deer up by the cabin and sometimes even shoot them out the windows of the cabin. And, you know, you're putting very little pressure on a property doing that. So when people ask what I do on my farm, that doesn't mean that that's going to apply to you. But the other thing I want to throw out is, don't think that I cannot relate to a different situation. And I'll throw out some facts and figures here. My top six bucks were killed on five different properties. Those five different properties were in three different counties. So I've got more experience than just here on this one farm. So we may relate stories and questions may pertain to my home farm, but that doesn't mean that 100% of my experience is on this farm. And it does not mean that what I'm sharing with this home farm is going to apply to your property.
All right. All right. Well, let's take a quick break and hear a message from Quiet Cat.
If you listen to many of our podcasts, you know that minimizing human intrusion is the key to our success. Don Higgins and I have been utilizing the Quiet Cat Bike for many years now. As shed season is here, turkey season is not far away. There's no better choice to navigate around your property than a Quiet Cat Bike. Go visit Quiet Cat and use the word Higgins to get a free trailer with any Quiet Cat electric bike purchase.
All right, Don, our third question of the night is from Steve Dooley.
Yeah, Steve is from Emerson, Arkansas. And he says, Don and Terry, thanks for all you guys do. As a Christian hunter with five kids, your podcast keeps me motivated to use my love for hunting as a platform to teach others about Christ and give glory to God for everything. First question, why doesn't Real World Wildlife Products sell cereal rye? Here in the Dirty South, I'm not sure what the Dirty South is, but new phrase for me, but here in the Dirty South, winter rye is almost a staple for food plotters because it does well in sandy soil and survives our typically mild winters. Is there a specific negative factor about cereal rye that we should keep in mind? Second question, what is your opinion on the best way to have an article published in a major deer hunting magazine? I've wrote for three different hog hunting magazines and even had my own column in one of them, but have never submitted anything to a deer hunting magazine. I guess the main reason is because I don't think many people look at Arkansas as a big buck producing state, which I agree that it typically is not, thus possibly preventing hunters from here being taken seriously. Killing the best mature buck available in an area should be the focus, though, regardless of inches, in my opinion, and that's what I strive for. I'm over 40 years old, which you have said to be the minimum age requirements for publication, LOL, and have a passion for writing as well as deer hunting. Should I submit articles, be prepared for rejection, and keep trying? I know there's a lot of talented writers out there, so I don't expect to nail it on first, second, or even 10th attempt. Thanks for all you and Terry are doing, and keep up the good work. Well, Steve, first, your question on rye, why we don't sell rye. Well, rye is readily available at just about any seed house that you might find, any ag supplier. Rye is very common for ag cover crops. We absolutely could sell rye. We have rye in some of our blends, but just from an economic standpoint, a person in the South could go and buy a bag of rye and save a whole lot of money rather than ordering it online and paying the shipping and everything. So that's the big reason.
When you do tissue analysis of rye, Don, Wes, myself cannot look anyone in the eye and say that a specific variety of cereal winter rye has an advantage over another cereal rye. At least we haven't found it yet. So if it's just a matter of putting a product in a bag that you can get probably easier and don't have to pay shipping, we're not going to deceive the consumer by trying to pretend that it's something it's not, like every other business in the industry does. If we find a niche or a advantage like NutriCrave corn, where it's revolutionary to the industry and to the product, miscanthus for another example, that's the type of things that we look for in a product. So it doesn't discourage, we're not trying to discourage someone from using it, but if we do not have a clear advantage of something that we would promote with it being over another product, we don't waste our time with it.
Another good point, Terry.
So the writing thing, I'm interested to hear your answer on this one.
Well, you know, just like anything in the outdoor industry, there's tens of thousands of people trying to get their foot in every angle they possibly can, including as an outdoor writer. And you know, with the publications today shrinking because of social media and the internet, magazines have fewer and fewer pages, so there's fewer and fewer opportunities for new riders. My suggestion would be that you start with smaller regional or localized publications. Get your feet wet that way and get your name out there a little bit and grow from there. If you get a chance to meet a magazine editor at a sports show or something, you know, just take a minute of their time if they're willing and, you know, ask them some advice on how to get published. It's just a different world today. The other thing is you can get online and you can publish things without limit. The internet's given everyone a voice, and you can start your own blog online and grow from there. Maybe you'll be noticed by someone who can open that door for you to start writing for magazines. But my best advice to you is just put out volumes and volumes of material, get your name recognized. And the fact that you're in Arkansas, I don't see that as a deterrent. I mean,
not at all.
You can sit in your house in Arkansas and write just as well as I can in my house in Illinois. So I don't see that as a hurdle whatsoever. But just get your name out there as much as you can, whether it's in a printed publication or an online venue.
I think from the marketing perspective that I come from, don't focus as much on print publication, because that's a dying thing. You know, even we've cut way back on our advertising and print ads in published magazines. The return on it is just not there. There is still a lot of people that get North American Whitetail and deer hunting and enjoy that catalog, but the appeal to print catalog is dying. It's something of the past. Find your new niche, find that new thing, be ahead of the curve is where you need to focus on versus something that's dwindling. Cause as the print publication continues to dwindle, the subscribers get, less, advertisers start to pull out, and then guess what? The writing is saturated and there's just not as many publications as there were before. So, but good questions, but I appreciate the comment at the beginning of the question about his faith and sharing that with his five children. I think that'll be more of a more rewarding investment of your time than writing an article ever will. All right, so let's take a quick break and hear from Lester's Feet.
Today I want to introduce you to the Dow family from Illinois. A listener to the Chasing Giants podcast told us about this family in the fall of 2021. We reached out to the family to learn more and immediately fell in love with their family and their story. This family is currently navigating the care of their child, so instead of asking them to worry about putting a video together, I just wanted to share the story, introduce you to them, to know who you could pray for today. In April of 2019, this young couple, Andy and Beth, along with their son Grayson, were surprised with the news that a baby boy was coming. While it was really not that long ago, to this family, it seemed like an eternity. The family welcomed this little baby boy named Waylon into the world, and life seemed so perfect. But on April 15th of 2020, their world would come to a screeching halt. This otherwise healthy, chubby, bubbly baby boy was diagnosed with a form of sarcoma. What started out thinking that this little bump on his eyelid was a sty turned into a life-altering event in just a matter of 3 weeks. The preliminary biopsy was negative and the tumor was removed. The family thought that they were in the clear. They thought they had dodged a bullet and went home thinking how lucky they were, but Andy and Beth took him to his appointment thinking they were just going for a routine checkup. But little did they know, their life was getting ready to hit a brick wall going 100 miles an hour. This C word, especially for a parent to learn of their child, just heartbreaking. Like many parents, Andy and Beth would do anything to trade places with him. Staying strong for the family, Andy and Beth held things together, as they started navigating and receiving treatment in St. Louis. They were just normal parents of a healthy baby boy, but in just a matter of 24 hours, they became cancer parents. At just 4 months old, this family started a journey. A normal baby milestone might be sitting up, rolling over, crawling, saying mama, dada, was quickly replaced with milestones as he's getting his chemo for 3 months. Normal family activities were divided into these intervals because that's when he gets his scans to make sure the cancer hasn't returned. It's truly an indescribable fear. On June 7th, 2021, almost two-year-old Waylon finally rang that bell. His cancer was in remission, and the big sigh of relief and hopelessness of the future to come, the family, Andy, Beth, and Grayson, became busy campaigning for the future, starting to raise money for other families that had gone through what they had. But later in September, Beth's intuition and an MRI scan showed Waylon's cancer had returned. Thankfully, it was caught early, again, and remained contained to the eye orbit. The family heard some words they never wanted to hear. Your child's cancer is back. Immediately, Beth began to research and consult with others to learn about potential treatments outside of St. Louis Children's. She reached out to a few other hospitals for second opinions, and after what seemed like to be divine intervention, it led them to a very fast second opinion turnaround. The families quickly switched gears and decided that the hospital in New York was the right place for Waylon's treatment. With the future ahead calling for many trips to New York, medical bills, lodging, meals, time off work, this is when God connected the Lester's Feet Foundation to the family. With the help of the donors, the monthly expenses back home were taken care of while Andy and Beth traveled to New York to continue treatment and surgery. In late 2021, Waylon had a surgery to remove his eye and his eye socket. This life-changing procedure felt like a couple steps backwards, but in the long run was his best path forward. After allowing time to heal from this procedure, the chemo would start back again, and the battle would continue. Overall, he's had a rough go of it since starting chemo. They even had to visit the emergency room on Christmas morning and did not return home till New Year's Eve. As of February 2022, the family is just simply exhausted. Andy and Beth have done what every cancer mom and dad would do. That's put their child first. Older brother Grayson, who is now 12, has been awesome with the situation, but we know it's wearing on him as well. This upcoming 9 months of chemo has started out extremely rough. Although the eye area is healing, the battling of fevers, ear infections, and other sickness has resulted in a lot of time admitted into the hospital while trying to start this gruesome 9 months of chemo. When Lester's Feet reaches out to check on Andy and Beth, they always say they're doing fine. They're just struggling with the situation. Never wanting to draw attention to themselves, they always ask us to help spread the word about childhood cancer. While Lester's Feet's going to continue to stand behind the family financially when they need it, God, we come to you today, heartbroken, worried, concerned, even angry, that this dreaded disease affects so many little ones. We know that your grace, your mercy, through your son Jesus, provides the assurance that one day there'll be no pain, there'll be no fear, there'll be no risk. We know that through your son Jesus that we have the assurance of an eternal happy place with no sickness. But for right now, we just lift this family, Andy, Beth, Grayson, and Waylon, up to you. We ask for healing, we ask for comfort, and most of all, Father, we ask you to lay your hands over them, draw them closer together, help this little boy fight this disease, and grow up living like a normal boy would. Together, right now, praying, Father, we pray that not only for Waylon, but all the other families that we come in contact with, watch over them and protect them. In Jesus' name.
The Lester's Feet Foundation is a 100% volunteer, nonprofit organization whose sole mission is to help families with sick children. The impact on families who have children with life-altering illnesses can be devastating and often requires one or both parents to be away from work. Through our fundraising efforts and the help of our generous donors, Lester's Feet works with families to help alleviate the financial burdens associated with caring for their children through such a challenging time. 100% of donations and fundraising profits go directly to the families we are supporting. We are excited to announce that Solid Rock Chapel in Sullivan, Illinois is supporting our foundation by hosting a huge raffle with $150,000 worth of prizes, including a new Chevy truck, a John Deere tractor, a material kit to a post-frame building, and much more. The drawing will be on July 4th, 2022, so please visit us at www.lestersfeetfoundation.org to purchase your raffle tickets and learn more about our organization.
All right, well, Don, the ad in the Busy Beaver came out this week, and we've started getting those checks mailed in from all of our Amish friends, and we do greatly appreciate that. But there's just two things that I need to make sure everybody understands. We are a group of just a couple volunteers. So if you're going to buy a ticket, please do not wait till the last minute at the end of June to do it, whether it's online or mailing in a check. It helps us out so much if you can do that earlier. The second thing is, I've gotten a couple phone calls because the ad in the Busy Beaver says to mail the check to Solid Rock Chapel. And then on the podcast, I've said to mail it to Lester's Feet Foundation. Both will work. The reason I did that, I just didn't explain it to everybody, is so it divvies up the amount of processing that has to be done. So your wife, Robin, has been gracious enough to help us on that end. And then we have people down here. So when these floods of checks come in, whether it's from our podcast listeners or the people that get the Busy Beaver publication, they go to two different places and then get deposited in the exact same account. You get the exact same ticket. It just gets it to two different people to help us process. So again, thank you so much to everyone who's bought tickets thus far. We got a little over a month to push this thing over the finish line, and I can't wait to see how God uses this. It's been a real blessing to see how everything's unfolded.
Yeah, don't wait to buy your tickets. Get them bought now, and we only got, what, a little over a month, and we'll be drawing a winner.
All right. So, and I do want to make a point. If you do read the terms and conditions of the raffle, if there's something on that raffle that you cannot take possession of, say you can't have the truck or don't want the truck, you do not have to take that. You can sell it. You can donate it back to the foundation. We can give it to a family. There's a lot of different things that you can do. And at the end of the day, I realize that people are buying tickets to win something, but that's the small piece of the puzzle. We're buying tickets to be a light to people who have sick children. So just remember that as we're going, but you do not have to take, if you live on a quarter acre lot and you win the post frame building, you don't have to take that. So I might buy it from you. There's a good chance that whoever wins it, I'll make an offer to buy it, but we'll go there when the time comes. So let's put up question number 4 for you to read off.
This question comes from Mike Russell from Woodsfield, Ohio. Mike says, Don, it is often said that as a deer gets older, his home range begins to shrink. Do you believe this is true? And if so, why do you feel this happens? Well, Mike, I do think that in many cases it is true. You've heard me say hundreds of times that bucks are individuals. Just like people are individuals. With that said, you know, a lot of bucks, as they mature, their home range shrinks. They cover less and less territory. And I think to explain it, you just think of it in human terms. I mean, you know, here I am pushing 60 years old. I guarantee you, I don't cover the area around my home like I did when I was in my 20s. Well, Terry and I are sitting here on a Saturday night recording this, and I'm sitting in my house and have no desire whatsoever to leave my house until I go to church tomorrow morning. 30 years ago, it would have been a different story. You wouldn't have caught me in my house at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night. And, you know, bucks are the same way. As their testosterone levels decrease as they get older, they just don't have the desire. They find a place where they feel secure, where all their needs are met, food and security mainly. And they just don't have a reason to leave. And most of the time, that's the case.
Yeah, I think that's the older I get, the fewer friends I want, and the more I want to go anywhere. So,
and they become loners too. You know, they just you know, we've talked about the old buck that I've got on my farm right now that'll be 9 and a half this fall. He's in the last two seasons, he's become a loner. He doesn't want to hang around other deer. He doesn't show up during the rut he used to show up before the rut and stay here and participate in the rut. The last 2 years, he has not showed up until after the rut was over, and he's showing up for the food. And then when he does show up, he stays by himself off on a corner of the property and is not even with the rest of the herd. And it's because he's just an older male.
Grumpy old man.
There you go. Just like me.
All right. All right, well, we'll go straight to question number 5. This is a long one, so I want to leave enough time to get through it.
Okay, this one comes from Joel Gehr. I hope I'm saying your name right, Joel, from Nashville, Tennessee. He says, "Hey, Don, during podcast episode 110, you talked about some people micromanaging a property layout and making things overcomplicated. You went on to mention that some mature bucks refuse to walk through tight funnels and pinch points. I have a two-part question in hopes that you can elaborate on this a little bit. Part one, I remember you mentioning that you will put up a fence in the woods to pinch deer down to walk within bow shot of your stand. Is this kind of pinch point going to prevent some bucks from walking through because of differences in buck personalities? How wide do you think a pinch point needs to be for all buck personalities to feel comfortable walking through the pinch? Part two, in the blind you killed Smokey out of, did you create an open gate for the deer to walk through as they come out of the woods? If so, does this kind of pinch point seem to funnel most of the mature bucks that are coming in and out of the woods? If you had to guess, what percentage of your mature bucks use the open gate as opposed to going in and out of those woods somewhere else along that food plot? Will some mature bucks avoid this open gate at all times? Thank you for everything that you and Terry do through the podcast." First question. What was that first question, Terry? That was so long. I forgot the first part.
The fence in the woods to direct them or pinch them down within bow range. So I think this is when you talked about if say you have a neck in a woods that says goes down to about 50 yards, you can run a hog panel or a section of fence in that 50 yards to get them to skirt around a little bit to be within bow range at a strategic point. I think that's the conversation we were having that he's referring to.
Yeah. Or a picket fence.
Yep.
Or something like that. Yeah. So when you do that, you know, each buck, again, he brought up the point himself that each buck has a different personality, and some bucks will walk through an opening in a fence, you know, that's, you know, a foot wide, where others won't. And I like to have an opening, if possible, 20 yards or so. I don't even really want them to know that they're being pinched down. I can remember a situation on my farm many years ago where there was some old cattle fence that ran through the farm, and I cut an opening between two fence posts. And I'm going to say those fence posts were probably 15 feet apart. So, you know, I cut along one post and I pulled that wire clear back to the next post. and created a 15-foot wide opening. And I remember one afternoon sitting there, and I'm watching a string of deer coming right to that opening, out of the wooded cover to a food plot. And the first 10 or so deer were does and fawns, and every one of them walked right through that opening that I'd cut in the fence. And then behind them came a buck, a three-year-old buck, and he refused to walk through that opening, but instead, about 20 yards from that opening where he could have just walked straight and followed those deer right through the opening, instead he veers out of his way and jumps the fence just 20 yards from that opening. And I will say that I had a trail camera on that opening, and I don't know if he was avoiding the trail camera or he was avoiding that small opening in the fence, but whatever, that's just one firsthand experience that comes to mind immediately when we talk about this. But I like to leave that opening wide enough that the deer really doesn't even realize he's being pinched.
Yeah, I think that the two parts of his question relate to the first one being using fence in the woods, which would be more like down by the creek on the west side of your creek, where you just have a section of fence. As they're coming north and south, they just veer to the left. So the deer can go either way. In your case, there's a real deep ravine on a creek where they would have to jump that and go around versus walk around the fence. So I think the first question or first part of his question is more in the woods, when you're just trying to direct them. You know, that deer is going to walk either way. I don't really consider that being pinched. You're pushing them one side or the other, right, to get them close enough to bow range. Then he gets on to the topic of the smoky blind, where you have the gap in the fence there, and you can talk a little bit about the smoky blind, even though smoky's probably not a real good example of that, because smoky came out of the native grass and was out in the open field coming back into the food plot that was the perimeter around it. But Smokey did go in and out of that gap, though.
Yeah, he did a lot. And the gap he's talking about, everyone that's ever been to my Whitetail Master Course has seen this fence crossing or gate, if you want to call it such, right in front of the Smokey blind, where they come out of the wooded cover the one side into the food plot, and then the other side of the food plot's where the bedding grass is. So that gap there is probably about 15 feet wide. I don't think I've ever had a buck on the farm avoid that gap. It's definitely the easiest place for them to cross out of the woods. If I have had one, I just don't remember it. So they use it. Now, I will say that what will happen on my property, and it's not a big property, keep that in mind, is that one mature buck will get from point A to point B using one route, and a different buck will use a totally different route to get from point A to point B. And if you have cameras on both of those routes, you rarely get one buck's picture on one camera while you always get him on the other, and vice versa. So a individual buck will have his own preferred route across or through or around your property. You need to keep that in mind. And I don't know that it's related to things like fence gaps or anything like that, because I've seen it happen on properties where there really is no fence. Have multiple cameras and you get one buck's picture here all the time and the other buck rarely.
I think it's possible, no matter what you do, that you're always going to have a buck that doesn't like something that goes a different route. But I think over time, as the deer herd gets used to it, or that buck learns and grows up, and you're not putting a lot of intrusion at that gap, I would think that it's probably more due to the pressure that you're putting on that gap, either hunting it wrong or checking trail cameras wrong. That's probably causing that buck to not like that area. He smelled something there that he doesn't like, maybe one time, or maybe he was bedded down really close to it, and you walked in to check a trail camera. So the thing that we don't talk about about the Smoky Blind, even on your masterclass. I was thinking about this the other day. The thing that I think is so special about the Smoky Blind is when those deer come out of that gap, catty corner from that opening in the fence to the switchgrass is 30 yards maybe, because it's right in an elbow of the food plot. And then you have really tall pine trees that continue to go out straight away from it. So think about it this way. If that deer's coming out and your gap is open, where anything can see, anything can, no cover, yeah, they probably don't like that. They're probably going to stay back till after dark. But when those deer come through the Smoky Blind, they have hard edges on both sides. They're like at this inside corner with food right in front of them. And then if something were to happen when they're right outside that gate, 2 seconds, they're out in the middle of that native grass field that, you know, lost in the maze. So I think what's really special about how you've set that inside corner up is that it feels more secure in that corner than probably, you know, any other place that they could come out and feed. There's cover in all directions and security, you know, where they know what's there and what's not.
Yeah, and you just got a lot of different habitat types coming together right there as well. You got the corner of the switchgrass field, you got the food plot, you got the wooded cover, and then right behind the blind, you've got the big spruce trees, you got the spruce thicket. And so yep. All those different, and then you got the open ag field. So it's almost like a hub of about 5 different types of
right
there at once.
Yeah. We don't talk about that. We probably need to add that to the list of what we talk about, you know, on how to use gaps, maybe at your masterclass. But if you go back and look at Don's social media accounts from back in March, where we would take the group picture in front of the Smoky Blind, that's the only time I know that we've taken a picture looking back at the blind, where people can see that the spruce trees that the blinds put inside of, you know, all the other pictures we take looking out over the native grass. But when you really lay it out that it's at that intersection of all of those different types of structure coming together, you're really in probably the safest feeling area. So that's why maybe the deer use it more. But I'm just going to guess, Don, that the people who have experiences with deer not using gaps might be that they're pressuring those gaps just a little bit too much as part of the deal.
That's where I was going to go next, Terry. If you know, a deer has caught you at that gap in your stand, they winded you at that gap, maybe a trail camera has spooked them, as I alluded to earlier in that story. Then yeah, I can absolutely see deer and specifically individual deer avoiding gaps in a fence.
Yep. All right. Well, that's 5 questions today we burnt through. We got an announcement for our Amish friends. We just haven't found the right method to get questions in from our Amish folks. So we've come up with an idea we're at least going to try for the time being. So why don't you go over that?
Yeah, so, you know, just this week, I talked to a couple different Amish friends that said they wish they had a way to submit questions to the podcast. And up to this point, it was just way easier to have them submitted on the website. So if at all possible, go to chasinggiants.com and submit your questions there. But for those Amish friends who do not have access to the internet, we're going to allow you to write down your question and mail it in. And I'm going to give you the address here in just a second, give you a chance to grab a pencil and paper. But here's the thing to keep in mind. When you send in your question, make sure you put your name and your address and also your t-shirt size. I don't know if you're going to wear a Chasing Giants t-shirt, but you're going to have one anyway. You can give it to somebody or whatever, but put down the size of the t-shirt you want. And I'm going to have you send those to the Real World Wildlife Products office. And so you're going to want to address your envelope to Real World Wildlife Products, P.O. Box 5555 in Arthur, Illinois. And the zip code in Arthur is 61911. And we will gather those. And when you guys start sending them each week, I'm going to pick a couple of Amish questions that were sent in, you know, written on a letter. And then I'll also pick some that were submitted on the website. So we'll look forward to start getting some of those. I know a lot of you have wanted to submit questions for some time, and we're going to start to doing that and using some of your questions.
Yeah. So a couple things, we've been trying, but the voice to email doesn't seem to work real well after checking into it. But please also understand, you might want to submit a question and don't want your name known. So you don't have to disclose, you can just say, keep my name anonymous at the beginning of your question. We'll still mail you back a small thank you gift for submitting your question if we use it, but we won't read your name on air, because somebody might want to ask a question because of their naughty neighbor that they're wanting to put a high fence up next to. You never know. So don't feel like that you have to let us say your name on the show. If you're not comfortable with that, we can obviously keep your name anonymous and then just mail you back your thank you. Okay.
Yeah. I look forward to getting some of those submissions, because I know we got a lot of Amish listeners, and they have not, for the most part, been able to submit a question yet. And we ought to have a flood of them coming in now.
Yep. So get those questions in, mail them to Real World Wildlife Products, PO Box 55, Arthur, Illinois. So with that, Don, that's all I got. I'll be honest with you. I need to bush hog at the farm and mow my clover. My clover's looking a little rough, but I saw my first fawn today, and I'm probably going to just let her go for about a month. I don't know. I'm not baling hay, but I don't know. Want to know that it's worth risking running over a fawn.
It's that time of the year. They're going to really start dropping here now. Whenever I had the captive deer years ago, I would always count on Memorial weekend. I would have fawns during Memorial weekend, but a lot of times I would have some before, definitely some after. But that Memorial weekend always seemed to mark fawning season.
Yep. So be careful when you're out. And like I said, I might mow the path down the middle of the ridge or something, just so it's not as bad getting in and out. But I'm going to stay out for the most part until I'm sure that these fawns can get up away from the tractor. So with that, I don't have anything else. How about you?
Nope. Have stories from Mississippi next week, and hope we get some dry weather, and hope everybody gets their food plots in, including you and I.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Have a great week.
God bless, everyone.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo, Bia Farm Real Estate Company, 360 Hunting Blinds, Victory Chevrolet, Real World Wildlife Products, Matthews Archery, Novix Tree Stands, Gingerich Tree Farm, WildlifeFarming.com, Quiet Cat, and Vortex Optics. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.